I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology for Tuesday, April 10th, 2007. And I'm going to go out of order a bit today. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2243. Patrick, would you give us a little bit of a rundown on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to. House Bill 2243 modifies the expiration date for certain licenses, permits, and certificates to allow agencies to establish by rule the expiration dates for those licenses and certificates. It removes the discretion of applicants to choose at the time that they renew their license between the normal license term and the extended license term offered by an agency. Also included in your packets, you will find the Dash 5 amendments, which are have been a long time in coming. They adopt, they make several changes, which I believe one of our speakers will be speaking to the Dash 5s. And also you'll find the Dash 7 amendments, which are related to the Department of Aviation. I believe Senator Johnson is going to speak to those.
Okay, and so I'm going to start with Senator Johnson, if you would join us, please.
Thank you. And with the Chair's permission, may I bring up auxiliary forces?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your courtesy in allowing me to testify. And for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. The reason I'm here specifically on the Dash 7s and not on the underlying bill. And my interest in coming to talk to you about the Dash 7s is a rather unique set of circumstances that have manifested themselves at the Department of Aviation. I'm joined here at the witness table with by Dan Quam, who is the interim director of the Department of Aviation. And just by way of a little bit of history, I was a citizen activist around the creation of the Department of Aviation. It took us two sessions to get that accomplished. The Department of Aviation had been a division of ODOT, and given my observation of embedding an aviation agency inside this huge highway agency, aviation really wasn't getting the level of attention and advocacy that it needed. And the legislature agreed with me and with overwhelming numbers created the Department of Aviation in 1999. The department operated and did very well up until recently when they experienced a fiscal crisis under the watch of a manager who has since left the agency. Mr. Clem was tapped by the governor to come in and right the agency financially, and I am delighted to say has done a superlative job of doing that. Given Mr. Clem's advances in the agency in the last couple of months, there is interest in the aviation community, of which I am still a very active member, in having Mr. Clem continue at the agency, making sure that the efficiency and accountability and transparency measures that he has put in place hold, and supervising the recruitment and selection of another head of the Department of Aviation. When we created the Department of Aviation, we specified in statute that whoever ran the agency should have expertise in aviation or airport management. That was the desire of the aviation community at the time that supported this bill very aggressively. It now comes to pass that under the watch of someone with those credentials, the agency failed financially, and it has been someone with limited, without the credentials specified in the legislation, who has come out and fixed things. In order for Mr. Clem to be considered to continue in that post, we need to modify the statutes, and that would occur with the inclusion of the Dash 7 amendments. There's one other element in the Dash 7 amendments that I want to offer for your consideration, and hopefully I can make the case that it's a good thing. It has to do with aircraft registration that is a function overseen by the Department of Aviation. The Department of Aviation oversees pilot registration and aircraft registration, and again, to put this in context, the pilot registration has been the subject of some of the work done by the governor's recently concluded task force on search and rescue. And in the final report to the governor, a heavy emphasis was put on the need to refresh and revitalize the pilot registration requirements in order to help fund some of the state search and rescue activities. Simultaneously, there is a desire on the part of the department to make sure that all aircraft in the state are registered. Because of Oregon's unique tax situation, we are finding, and in the interest of full disclosure, I ran the Department of Aviation for 5 years, so this is not a unique problem. But we found that there are a lot of foreign aircraft registered in this state, yielding no benefit to the state of Oregon, but being shielded here under our very favorable tax situation with respect to personal property. I think it is the interest of the agency to clean up both the pilot registration and the aircraft registration, and in order to successfully accomplish those two tasks, they need to be more nimble in their ability to adjust fees. Ergo, the request in the Dash 7s to have fee setting moved from statute to administrative rule. And I come before you today to make that plea. I know that there are some on the panel with questions about that, simply because they want to assure agency accountability and not an agency pent-up desire to increase fees without legislative oversight. I would submit to you that while that's a valid argument, the Department of Aviation today presents an extraordinary opportunity to deliver on the unfulfilled promise of having the pilot registration function help fund search and rescue, and having the aircraft registration function provide revenue to the department that then can be matched against federal revenues, yielding grant programs available for all of our airports, and to have the whole system of airports in the state flourish as a result of that. And I would turn to Mr. Clem to make sure that I have not misstated any of the factual basis underlying the Dash 7s, but I would strongly commend the Dash 7s to your consideration.
Questions? Representative Beyer.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, it's the process now that if a fee is set by rule during the interim, that it has to come back in the next legislative session and be ratified, or is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, that's my understanding.
Other questions? So if I can follow up on what she just said, the only time that there would be a requirement under current regulation to be nimble and change fees would be during session. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's the case.
Thank you. Yes, would you like to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Clem, Interim Director, Department of Aviation. Just wanted to add to Senator Johnson's last statement, the ability to match those federal revenues is critical for us in some of the programs wherein we send out grant monies to local airports for their improvement purposes. Without any sort of consideration of being able to change those fees, it's highly unlikely in the next couple of years we'll be able to continue what's popularly known as the FAM grants, financial aid to municipalities. That's the means by which they improve their airports. They take that FAM grant money and they match it with local funds or county or economic development funds. So it has a downstream trickle effect, and I'd like to be able to keep the program alive.
Mr. Chair, if I could just augment that, I would say, based on my personal experience, this is a very small agency with a very activist constituency. I count myself among that member, given that a member of my family is still in the aviation business. I believe that if there were any abusive escalation of fees, that the aviation community would howl like mashed cats, and it would give plenty of opportunity for the legislature to come in and redress whatever bad agency behavior had occurred on Mr. Clem's watch. I'm hoping there will be no bad behavior.
Me too.
You look like you have another question.
Well, I do. I guess that I'm not as clear as I thought I was, so based on his last statement. But these can be set by rule during the interim and can be charged at that point, but when we come back in and review budgets during session, if people think they're out of line at that point, they can be readjusted. But is this accurate, or am I?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, that's my understanding.
And if we pass this bill as it sits, the fees that you set would require, and not just ratification, but a bill to reverse that.
Mr. Chair, if the aviation community, for example, thought that the fees set by administrative rule, which has a public process, but if the aviation community thought that those fees were excessive, I'm sure that they would come to members of the legislature and complain about it. I just want to emphasize again that all administrative rule promulgation has a very public process attached to it, and I know from my personal observation of previous rule writing at the department that there were no shortage of people that, and it had nothing to do with fees, it had to do with the promulgation of other rule, there were no shortage of people willing to come forward and testify very aggressively with respect to their opinion about rule writing. So I know that the panel is trying to be cautious about the potential for abuse in rule writing, and as one of the people who pays those fees, I can say with considerable assurance that I believe Mr. Clem and the agency will be under a magnifying glass to make sure that the fees promulgated in rule are appropriate, judicious, and in the case of looking at foreign aircraft registration in this state, efficacious.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Senator Johnson, and we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for your consideration of the Dash 7s.
I'm going to call Patrick Allen. Understand? I know you're more interested in the underlying bill than in the Dash 7.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Patrick Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I'm always terribly interested in what Senator Johnson wants as well, but but yes, the underlying bill and the Dash 5 amendments. Just very briefly, and I know I've talked individually with most of you about this, the underlying bill does two things. The bulk of what you see, which is summarized in a document you have that looks like this, takes every single statutory reference we could find to a license expiration date where the actual date is in statute, and adds to that language that allows the agency to either use that date or such other date as it might set by rule. What this does is allow agencies, without having to come back with individual bills to the legislature, to do things to equalize workload on renewals over the course of a year. Birth month license renewal is the most common tactic. What that does, in addition to smoothing out the workflow, really from my standpoint in terms of regulatory streamlining, it helps agencies troubleshoot better. If all of your licenses come due at one time, someone comes in with a problem, which invariably happens, and the ability of the agency to go resolve those kinds of things goes down when they're all there at the same time. So that's that issue. The second issue, it's the first section of the bill, actually. Last session, you passed a bill that allowed agencies to look at licenses that had a statutory duration, typically 1 year, and let the agency consider, is there a public policy reason it really needs to be a one-year license, or could it be a longer term license, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever? And you passed legislation that allowed them that discretion. To do that, we needed to include language last session that said, this might be a cash flow impact on small businesses, so let's give them the choice, the statutory license or a longer term license. In reality, as we worked over this past interim, that having a choice issue turned out to be hugely more complicated than we expected in terms of trying to implement. You'd have licensees with the same kind of a license with different dates, parallel accounting systems. It rendered that solution something that we really couldn't make use of. So what this does is it takes that that choice out of statute. Agencies still have to go through an administrative rule process where they engage with their stakeholders on setting what is an appropriate length of term, but then they go ahead and set that longer term. We did find in a project that we ran with convenience stores where we bundled a bunch of licenses together, and that created also a larger fee. We did some polling after the fact, and that larger fee wasn't a factor at all for those small businesses. They were much more interested in paperwork reduction and those kinds of things, and so we feel fairly comfortable with that. That's the base bill. Let me quickly tell you what's in the Dash 5 amendments. First of all, they're Dash 5 because Dash 1 through 4 have been rolled together into them, so those aren't wandering around out there somewhere missing in action. The first part of the Dash 5s eliminates one of the licenses in the original bill, and that's the Department of Transportation billboard license. You may recall this past summer, I think, Transportation lost a court case having to do with their program for licensing billboards. They're off resolving those issues, but they wanted to go ahead and take that element out of this bill and not and deal with that in the larger discussion they're having. The second piece is a proposal by the Restaurant Association, which my office endorses strongly, to work with local county health officials and the State Department of Human Services to create a licensing portal where particularly a restaurant owner with multiple locations can go into a portal and do multiple renewals in multiple counties. You have in your packet a letter from the Department of Human Services speaking favorably about that. I think to sort of boil down issues that have been forwarded onto me from the counties and from DHS, Human Services wants to make sure ultimately they have actual resources to deliver that product. The counties want to make sure that whatever product gets delivered actually works. Fortunately, in the case of restaurant licensing, there's a work plan process where all those stakeholders and the restaurant owners come together and do an annual work plan on how restaurant licensing works, and so there's a vehicle to deal with that. The third thing, related to that, there was a bill that passed last session, House Bill 2005, that let my office work with multiple agencies on combined licensing projects where a single business was licensed by multiple organizations, and if we could try to do a combined license, you often had dates or due dates or grace periods that varied from agency to agency, and that bill allowed those to be equalized. It had a sunset, so that piece of the Dash 5 amendment eliminates the sunset and lets us continue with that. And then finally, unrelated to all of that, Senator Johnson mentioned the Administrative Procedures Act. This is, I think, a small fiddle with the Administrative Procedures Act. There are certain rules that can be changed that are technical in nature that don't require the full-blown rulemaking process where you have to do public notice and engage with stakeholders. This would expand that list to include the names of divisions, the names of programs, addresses of locations, and specifically says as long as those changes don't result in a substantive change in whatever the underlying program or structure is. So that's what you have in the base bill and in the Dash 5 amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Perry.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association, and I want to endorse the Dash 5 amendments as Mr. Allen has worked with us, the counties and DHS, and just want to note it for the record that by this bill passing doesn't mean we get to go out and do it. Anything changed under the food code is all you guys represent counties where county health departments are actually providing this service for the state to restaurants. So the law requires any rules changed under that has to go through a food plan work group, which is an equal representation of counties, DHS, and the Restaurant Association. But as Mr. Allen spoke, our OLCC is now going to My License, which is a software program through DAS. Our hope is someday we could probably do this through My License. So not only could you do multiple counties, but you could go online and do a drop-down menu and get multiple kinds of licenses. It's a long-term goal. It's not going to happen between now and next session, but we're hoping 5 to 10 years down the road we might be able to get that. But it'll have to go through the food plan work group in the interim to get consensus from the counties and the state and us. So with that, I hope you'd support the Dash 5s and the bill as a whole.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I think one question for maybe Pat Allen.
Oh, for Pat Allen. Yeah. Pat, could you come back and join us?
I think I know the answer to this, but could you tell me if there's any fiscal impact? I mean, because they're talking about it may have fiscal impact, but with all these dashes being talked about.
Again, for the record, Pat Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Thank you, and I actually neglected to mention that. Through the Dash, the base bill and the Dash 5s, as we know everything now, does not have a fiscal impact. I think I've come and said something like that on a similar bill earlier, but I'm pretty comfortable that what we're looking at here doesn't have a fiscal impact. The aviation issue that Senator Johnson spoke to may have fiscal issues related to it, and I really can't speak to those.
And, Patrick, would you tell us what you know about that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thatcher, I spoke to Adrienne Sexton, who's the fiscal analyst assigned to this bill, and she indicated that the Dash 7 amendments, because they address because they would allow the aviation department to set fees by rule, that's a kind of change that, it, while it may not have fiscal impact, it is an issue that may require ways and means review. And so that is the input I received from them.
Okay.
Right. And committee members, my understanding is the same, that if we pass the Dash 7 amendments to this bill, we will not be able to pass this bill out of committee today because it will require a ways and means, and that requires special, it has to go to the speaker has to allow it. So we could pass the Dash 5s, we could pass the Dash 7s. If we pass the Dash 7s, that's as far as we can go. If we pass the Dash 5s and not the Dash 7s, we could work the bill itself. So that's our options. What I propose, and I would take discussion on this, is to hold off on this bill, get the permission from the speaker, pass the Dash 5s and the Dash 7s in the next work session. And is there any discussion that we'd like on that?
Actually, I know I came in late. I'm kind of sorry. The Dash 7s, the problem I had, and maybe that's already been discussed, but the fact is that you go from a fee that's administered by rule versus the fee administered by statute. And I had problems with that, and I relayed that to the gentleman that just testified. So I have a little bit of problems with the Dash 7s. The Dash 5s are fine.
Okay. I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2243, and I'm going to hold off on a work session until a future date. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2864. Want to tell us about that, Patrick?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2864 revises provisions related to cemetery authorities. It revises provisions related to providers of prearrangement sales contracts and pre-construction sales contracts for funeral or cemetery merchandise. It also revises provisions related to endowment care cemeteries. It authorizes the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to issue emergency orders to restrict or suspend certain certificates or registrations to or order certified providers or master trustees to cease and desist from specified conduct. The measure allows the Attorney General to petition for appointees of receiver for certain providers.
Thank you. David Catlin? Did I say your name right?
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to have Charles Donald, the program manager, come up.
Absolutely.
Chair Riley and members of the committee, I'm David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and that is a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We feel that we are the largest consumer protection agency in the state and take this role very seriously. I'm here to provide some additional information about House Bill 2864, which, as the administrator said, or committee administrator said, amends and adds to ORS Chapter 97. I've provided written testimony, and I will try and work from that without tediously just reading it. This was the product of a work group that got together last year to update Chapter 97 and to change some of the definitions to bring them more in line with the current practices within the industry. And it was spearheaded by our division to try and address some of the needed modernization, but also to address some practices that we were seeing that gave us some concern. The group included representatives from funeral homes, cemeteries, banks and trust companies, consumer groups, and state agencies. ORS Chapter 97, as you heard, pertains to the management of cemeteries as well as the disposal remains of human remains and the sale of pre-arrangement contracts. We typically call those pre-need contracts, so you may hear that term. Our division is charged with the limited role of overseeing the sale of these pre-need contracts. And a pre-need contract is simply a situation where a consumer decides they'd like to pre-plan for their cemetery or funeral needs, or maybe on behalf of a loved one. And so they will contract with the funeral home of their choice or the cemetery of their choice and pre-purchase merchandise or services. So we're talking about caskets, headstones, crypt niches, as well as the preparation of the remains. The consumer may pay the entire amount, or the consumer may choose to enter into a payment plan, an installment plan, if you will. If they choose to elect a guaranteed contract, that means that whatever the ultimate price they pay is, that will cover the cost of the goods or services, no matter what that cost may rise to, subject to inflation. So that is a good thing. We encourage that type of pre-planning on behalf of the public, and we think that's a good policy to promote. For a guaranteed contract, the certified provider may retain 10% of the price paid as a fee, while the remaining 90% of the guaranteed contract goes into trust to earnings or interest. And if it is a non-guaranteed contract, then the entire 100% has to go into trust. A trust account may be managed by a certified provider, or it may be managed by somebody known as a master trustee. And we don't have that many master trustees. I think we have about 12.
Eight.
Thank you. We have eight. And one of the benefits of the pre-need trust is that for any reason or no reason, a person who purchased one may cancel it at any time and receive back the funds that they paid into that, plus earnings subject to administrative fees. There are a number of positive things that you just heard about this bill that we commend. It strengthens enforcement provisions, which we think is always a good thing to help protect the public. It also provides for reporting on items of merchandise that are purchased with pre-need funds that currently are not being addressed in annual reports. It would require the reporting of the items purchased and identify those items to a particular purchaser. And so, again, we think that record would help protect the consumer when the funds are expended. It gives the director the authority to prevents on the sale of a funeral home or a cemetery, it prevents the transference of the certificate to sell these pre-need contracts without the director approving the transfer of that contract. So the fact that there's a sale of a funeral home or a sale of a cemetery doesn't automatically mean that that person gets to then handle these pre-need funds. And we think those pre-need funds are create a fiduciary relationship, so I think it's very important that we do some background review before somebody gets put in that position. And so that clarifies that the director has authority to do that. Finally, the proposed bill would give the director general rulemaking authority to clarify certain consumer protections and just administration of this program so that we can clarify certain points that at this point have become somewhat gray areas. There are three provisions in the bill that we have some concerns about, and I've talked with members from the industry, and we would like to get together and discuss this further. Those three provisions address three things. One, the conversion of trust funds to insurance policies. This was a practice that our agency learned about when we received some complaints, and we started an investigation. At the time, there were no limitations on that practice. We think that it's important that there be limitations on the practice of converting trusted funds into insurance policies. Our concern is that the language within the bill right now may not go far enough to protect consumers. We'd like to sit and talk with the industry to discuss that further and make sure that adequate consumer protection would be in the bill. Secondly, the industry has asked us to revisit the issue of distribution of funds when a pre-need contract is canceled. That doesn't take place that often, but when it does, we want to make sure that the consumer is going to be fully reimbursed for the money they put in, and we want to talk with the industry about the appropriate way to handle the distributions and yet ensure consumer protection. And then lastly, there's a definition of a master trustee. That is the individual who is hired by a provider to essentially manage the funds that are held to try and generate sufficient interest or income to cover any inflationary expenses that they may face over the course of a contract. We want to make sure that the master trustee, who is stated as a fiduciary in the bill, does not run into conflicts of interest and therefore couldn't serve both as the fiduciary master trustee and as a certified provider. The language right now is not clear about that, and we'd like to visit with the industry to discuss that further. As I say, we are in continuing dialogue right now with the industry. We'd like to meet to provide additional clarity and, if necessary, to fix unintended consequences. The industry has indicated to us that they are more than willing to meet with us. I realize time is getting short. We'd like to get together this week and address possible amendments and then get back to the committee administrator with a possible suggestive amendments for a future work session. I'd be happy to answer questions about the bills as I can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Todd Cochran. Thank you, Mr. Cochran. If you just state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. My name is Ty Cochran. I'm the legislative liaison for the Cemetery Association of Oregon. And I'd like to say Mr. Tapman, not being from the industry, is very knowledgeable of it, and he did a very good job. So a lot of things he said I was going to say, so I'll brief this up a little bit. This legislation may seem large, but it's a lot of housekeeping and definition changes from when the DCBS took over the fiscal regulations from the Secretary of State's office back in 1999, and I have to applaud them for the job that they've done since then. I want to point out a few of the changes that Mr. Tapman did not point out in regards to cemetery, mainly not for the trust funds or endowment care issues. One of them is on page 4. In regards to 97-220, it's a cleanup of something that the Cemetery Association of Oregon has always wanted to address in regards to the disinterment of human remains. In statute 97-630, there's a succession of heirs that direct the disposition of remains, which means who can direct the authority to inter the remains. The way that is written now is it would work in a reverse role if someone wanted to come in and disinter a person from a cemetery. We, as an industry, for a long time now have always wanted to stop that at a certain level, and we will be addressing an amendment with that on in 97-220, line 38, to where it will say surviving spouse, all children, or a parent. At that point, it would stop, and it would require a court order and consent from the cemetery authority to do that. Another one I wanted to address is the one of the areas that we wanted to address was the scattering of cremated remains. That's an arena we've always wanted to address for quite some time. Many people were using these as pre-funding mechanisms. Many of the people were setting those funds aside in trust accounts, and they were actually issuing deeds for areas that people had scattered remains in a cemetery. And the language that's provided in here now would mean that you would not have to trust funds set aside for future scattering, or it would not be a conveyance or need to be issued a deed in certain areas. So I want to clear that up if you're reading through this and it doesn't make sense to you. The last issue, as Mr. Tapman had spoke about, was the language in the when someone wanted to cancel a trust account. And we are going to work with them this week to get that straightened out. And hopefully when those amendments come through, that I would appreciate if we could see this go through the chambers.
The thing that you said you wanted to clear up, I'm not quite clear.
Okay.
On the scattering, what's the current practice
The current practice, Chair Riley, now is probably all over the board. What happens now if someone comes in to, say, my location and wanted to scatter remains? We have many people in the industry that operate cemeteries have, say, went out and planted a bunch of roses, and people come in and they say, hey, Mom always liked roses. We want to put her ashes, you know, down next to this rose. Some people wanted to come in and prepay, so at the time of their death, the cemetery, when they received the cremated remains, they would go place these ashes at the base of those roses. What I've seen at many of the cemeteries is that people are treating scattering of remains as a service. So if someone paid for it ahead of time, that money actually goes into a trust account, which it's always been, is it really a service or is it a conveyance of land? So the way that we've addressed it in this bill is that it would not be a conveyance of land. It would not be a trustable item if someone wanted to pay for it ahead of time.
Yes, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Riley.
I'm going back to your testimony about wanting an amendment in Section 2. That's for the, you want to remove the remains?
Right. We would like to see where the surviving spouse, it says surviving spouse or a child.
Yes.
We originally intended that to say and children.
Oh, and children.
Okay. Yes. The way it works now is that most certified providers would require all children's signature to make an interment, and not just one. We also would like to put in an amendment here that we left out, and that's probably my fault, that we left out parents also. So if you had a parents of a child. After that, after the child, we want to stop it at that point and force them to get a court order. The reason we want to do this is that we've seen in the last few years where great uncles, nieces have came in, and because they're in the succession of heirs of the right to make an interment, they think that they have the right to do a disinterment. They may do it for underlying purposes that we don't know about. It may be a vengeance thing. It may be that the property is so high valued now that they want to get that remains out and do something with it and resell the property.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? I'm going to close the public hearing on 2864. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3366. Yes, please, Patrick.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3366 directs the Department of Administrative Services to maintain records about contracts for consulting services and to report the information about those contracts to the Governor, the President of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House. It requires the Department to maintain records about state procurement contracts of more than $15,000 and to report the information about those contracts to the Governor, President of the Senate, and Speaker of the House, and stipulates that the reports are to be considered public records, save for the requirement that Social Security numbers of the contract employees be redacted.
Thank you.
I should mention this measure has a referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Would Ms. Lancaster come forward, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster. I'm with the State Procurement Office at the Department of Administrative Services, and I serve in the capacity of the Chief Procurement Operations Officer. I'm handing out some written testimony for your information today on House Bill 3366, and The first page basically gives our take on what the bill expects DAS to accomplish. Certainly the requirement to collect, maintain, and annually report various data from all state agencies on public contracts for collection services, or for consulting services, I'm sorry, and also all active procurement contracts over $15,000. There are definitions for these groups of contracts. And consulting services, quite broad in terms of the types, analysis, evaluation, research, training, data processing, etc. And then the second category of active procurement contracts includes but is not limited to a wide variety of various industries. And I'll comment on some of those as we move along in this analysis. The second part of the bill, subsection 4, requires state agencies to ask their contractors and subcontractors to provide additional information to the agency about their employment of individuals, and the agency then to keep those records. Then there's a reporting requirement. What I thought might be most helpful to you today would be to share with you some of the current collection of data that is going on, and then what the new collection of data that we think this bill would require, and where the gaps might be in those two data sets. Currently, statute does require state agencies to report information to DAS about contracts for personal services. Now, many of these personal services types are included in the definition of consulting services that is in the in-house Bill 3366. In addition, whenever a state agency pays more in a calendar year under a personal services contract that would have been historically performed by state employees performing the same work, the agency must also report this to DAS and include in their report a statement of justification for the greater costs. DAS then is to submit a biennial report to the state legislature on the use of personal services as required. And I did make a note that this report is a little delayed this year because we have just implemented a new reporting module in our procurement system, and so those reports are being processed and will be at legislative headquarters next week. I put on the back of this testimony for your information a chart that highlights the elements of information that we're capturing now. And so this summarizes some of those and then compares them to the new data collection pieces that House Bill 3366 anticipates. And what I noted in an analysis is that first of all, the information that the bill requires would come from a variety of agency systems and record-keeping activities that may or may not be electronically maintained. We don't know that for sure, but we do know that they are not centrally interfaced or integrated at this time. Much of the data is not procurement-related information per se, but is under different administrative processes and systems, particularly state agencies' accounting systems, and then expenditure and employment information, as we've previously mentioned. The Oregon Procurement Information System, which is known as ORPIN, has been developed at first as a standalone procurement system, and this is quite common among states. And however, it does not connect currently to any of the three major accounting systems. So at the very get-go, we start encountering some issues around how would we connect to other systems in state government and retrieve and collect the information. So there would be some customization to the system that would be required, and of course agency cooperation. And again, on the back page we've got columns that show what the system captures now, what appears on certain reports now, and then the customization of items required, those that might require new policies or rules, and then some sense of what staffing impact might be. So you can see reading down those columns of items that there are a number of things that are reported and a number of things that aren't right now. So again, that's sort of a visual guide for you to see the comparison. Finally, the DAS really has I think, some potential difficulty in determining and capturing the full array of data, where it affects structures of various government entities. For one thing, there are a number of state agencies who are not subject to DAS authority and indeed are not subject to the state procurement code. For example, the Oregon University System and the state lottery are both exempt from the code and from DAS procurement oversight. So this might be cause some issues. And in addition, there are over 500 statutory carve-outs which provide a certain amount of independent agency authority over key contracting activities. And examples of this are the highway construction program for the Department of Transportation, the building and care and maintenance of the state parks, certain activities of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so there are many different specific carve-outs that we would have to try to draw together. Now, the bill next requires, again, a detailed reporting, and there are some activities that are currently outside the code, such as grants, leases, repayment agreements, and intergovernmental agreements. So these would be areas, again, that we would have some question about our ability to corral all the data. Finally, then, the bill does require the collection of employment information from contractors and subcontractors that isn't currently a part of the contracting or procurement process. I am available for questions, and if there's any other, if you'd like me to walk you through any other parts of the chart I've provided, I'd be welcome to take those at this time.
Representative Byrne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you probably noticed, I'm one of the co-sponsors of this bill, and when I did sign on to it, I expressed a few concerns about the dollar amount in it, the $15,000, and thought maybe it should be a higher amount. Do you have any idea how that would affect what...
Thank you, Chair Riley. Representative Beyer, the $15,000 number did puzzle me a bit. Currently, state law requires a formal solicitation at the $150,000 level. So anything over $150,000, there would be a full published solicitation document with written proposals and bids that would be coming back from the supplier community. Under $150,000, there are informal processes, and they range from the $75,000 to $150,000 range, where an agency is expected to seek and obtain at least three written quotes or bids, down to the under $5,000 range, where an agency may make a direct purchase without having a formal solicitation process. The $15,000 figure is in that informal range currently, and you know, would of course require agencies to take their informal business and to report on that, you know, assuming we customize the procurement information system to receive that information. Now, I would tell you that currently the report that we provide on personal service contracts does start at $5,000. So, you know, agencies are expected to report in on a lot of that informal contracting for personal services at the $5,000 level or greater. So, it's. I hope that answers your question, ma'am.
Sort of. Thank you.
Richard Farad.
I got a question maybe for you.
Okay.
And since you're the sponsor of the bill.
Okay.
Why are we only notifying the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House?
Good question. And I honestly don't know the answer to that question. We could, once that report's out, my assumption is that who else would you like it to go to?
Well, it should be public information.
Oh, I think once it's in that report form, it is public information.
Yeah.
I mean, under the public laws, public notice laws, that's definitely public information as soon as it's in report form. Is that your understanding?
Chair Riley, that is indeed my understanding, and the bill has in a couple of places quite clearly states that all of the information and all of the public, all of these reports would be public information available to the public for inspection and copying, with the exception, as the committee administrator noted, of any private individual employee information that would have to be redacted or you know, covered up so that it would not be displayed, such as specific names or social security numbers.
Patrick, do you have any?
That language, Mr. Chair and representatives, is in subsection 3. There is language speaking to that issue, saying that those reports are public record, and also, I believe, in subsection 6. Mm-hmm. They're two separate reports.
You might want to change the summaries, because the summaries.
It's not long.
Yeah. Summary's not long, but I understand your point. Representative Thatcher?
I'm sorry, I walked in a little bit late. I didn't hear all the explanation, and I honestly didn't have a chance to go through this one too terribly carefully. But I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Is it for only consulting services or all procurement of services and goods and for all agencies? Is it all-inclusive, or is it just...
Representative Riley, Representative Thatcher, it is all-inclusive. The bill's construction is a little confusing to me, but the way I read it, the actual, that all contract activity, what is called all active procurement activity, contracts over $15,000 for consulting, construction, equipment, grants, leases, miscellaneous services, printing, repayment agreements, intergovernmental agreements, and goods are covered by the collection and reporting requirement.
I guess one more question. So what kind of reporting is required of the contractors and subcontractors? I'm just wondering how intensive this is expected to be on the business community.
Representative Riley, Representative Thatcher, the intensity of the effect on the business community, I'm not sure I'd want to speculate on because I don't have good data, but the requirement for employment, the employment annual employment report that each contractor would be make is global. It is large, so certainly there would be impact as contractors would have to provide that level of report, and it extends down to the subcontracting level. So there is a pretty global requirement for all of these types of work, these contracts over $15,000, that would be provided and then collected at the central level at DAS and then provided in public report.
I'm just wondering if we're already reporting some of this information, it would just be a matter of getting it to you, or if this would require new reporting, and I'm not sure. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, if anybody would know, you would, being a contractor.
Well, and there's lots of paperwork we fill out already.
Right.
And
right.
I'm wondering if all this information that they're wanting, I'll have to look at it a little closer, but is already available. It's just a matter of
my
data entry.
My take on this is that actual contractors would have very little, if any, new information required that it's going to fall on DAS to report what they can already get. I don't believe that the intent is for new information for contractors. But we'll ask some other folks that question as well. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Jerome.
Just a quick question. Thanks, Chair. Do you have any idea the cost that this plan in order to implement would run?
Representative Riley, Representative Gerard, we are completing the fiscal elements, and those are being transmitted through DAS to come over to Legislative Fiscal for its analysis. But the fact is that, as you can see on the back chart, there is much that is not programmed in our procurement system now, so we would have procurement system programming that would have to be achieved. That would be, I think we're, you know, it's going to be significant. And then the connection to other systems, that would be significant, and I think we're looking at some millions of dollars.
Imperial information, this does have ways and means.
Yeah. So that will be, of course, analyzed there and through your process.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On the back page, the chart,
yes, sir.
Are all of these report requirements listed down the left-hand side, the left-hand column, those would all be required under this piece of legislation?
Representative Riley, Vice Chair Edwards, the far left column, of course, is the report requirement that we believe has been called out by 3366. Okay. And then the second one to the left shows what we believe the current procurement information system does capture, and agencies are obligated to submit that information. And then, likewise, directly next to it is what would appear on the reports that are called for now. Then you see, of course, the movement into what would have to be added in terms of customization to current systems. Does that get at your question, sir?
It does, and thank you for the chart.
You're welcome.
It's easier for me to read than.
Good, thank you.
Perfect.
Yeah, I guess I have another question. Now that I'm looking at the column, and I'm
Patrick.
And she's kind of painted a picture that's all inclusive here.
Patrick.
Looking down the left-hand side of your chart, where it says number of contracted employees, I guess I'm not understanding what that means, because it's not necessarily that an agent is contracting for a number of employees, they're just contracting for something to be done. However,
right.
You get it done, and however many employees you use is. So would that be an additional, I guess that maybe that would be an additional, you would have to keep track of how many employees you use for accomplishing a particular job, even though there's a lot of turnover sometimes, and that would be really kind of hard to determine.
That's, of course, going to be all worked out in ways and means.
Okay. Types of services. Okay, well, I think
that's why there is a ways and means, and there's policy side, and you know we'll leave that up to the ways and means process to figure out how they have to do it.
I'm talking about the people.
No, the contractor.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, excuse me, I misunderstood.
Because if being a contractor,
yeah,
and a contractor, I'm usually a subcontractor, and if I'm asked to go do XYZ, I don't know, just as like an extra thing to keep track of how many employees accomplished XYZ, and how do you count an employee, because sometimes they could be there half a day and you'll have somebody else come in there another half a day, et cetera, you know, for weeks on end or more. I'm just wondering what you're trying to accomplish with that, if that's what you're after, or what you're exactly looking for, what you're trying to accomplish. I guess, what is your goal, Representative Riley?
Since I'm the sponsor of
yes.
the bill, I sponsored the bill for someone else, and my understanding is that this is to get at Is it better, is it cheaper to do things with employees or contractors? It's a attempt to look at ways to make the state government more efficient. Now, sometimes to do that, you spend money to save money. So that's my understanding.
Who is it for then? I did see
it was, well, it, actually, this was a bill that I was asked to sponsor under my own name, and I've done that.
I just wondered who asked you to sponsor it.
We'll do that offline.
Ah.
So, any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And if you would stick around, just in case we have more questions.
Sure, glad to.
I think we might. So I'm going to call as a panel John Mulvey, Jerry Rosencutter, and Sonia Richwine. And if I butchered any names, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Mulvey. I'm here representing Service Employees International Union Local 503, and I have a couple of our members here with me as well. I want to thank you for your work on government accountability and good government generally, and I would ask that you consider this bill in the light of good government, because that's really the goal that we're after in supporting it. The goal of the bill is to shine light on the use of private contracting in Oregon. The two most important things that we would like to see as a result of this bill being implemented is greater transparency in these transactions and greater accountability for entities that contract with the state and that use state funds. This has become an issue that's more and more in the public eye as various developments at the national level play out. If anyone watched the PBS NewsHour last night, there was a in-depth story on contracting abuses in the Katrina recovery, which is still going on. There are companies that are being investigated for abuses in contracting in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. People are becoming increasingly aware of problems at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, which is an entity that was contracted out to a private contractor about 5 years ago. We would suggest that the fact of it going to a contractor who took the staffing levels there from over 300 full-time staff down to under 100 full-time staff in the space of 3 years, that there's a causal connection between that and some of the abuses that have happened there. Here in Oregon, information is much harder to come by on the subject. We are aware of a couple of issues that have arisen that SEIU believes are the tip of the iceberg for other potential problems that exist that we may not know about. Many of you, I'm sure all of you, have seen the news reports about the scandal at the Department of Corrections relating to food buying there. We've been seeing news reports in the last couple of weeks relating to the organization that was contracted to operate the K-12 testing under the No Child Left Behind Act, and now that contract is being voided, and there will presumably be some litigation surrounding that. I've also seen, by the way, the scenario of a kind of revolving door between contractors and state agencies. The Secretary of State's office audited ODOT's office that administers contracts and identified at least one instance where a particular staffer from an engineering consulting firm went to work for ODOT, took the lead on awarding a $5+ million contract to that engineering firm, and within a couple of days had resigned from ODOT to go back to work for the firm again. These are some of the stories that have sort of bubbled up that we've been able to get some information on. But we have to ask the question, and I hope that you will too, of how much more is going on there. You may pick up the paper and see a story that has a lot of kind of human interest. As policymakers, it's incumbent on you and all of us, I think, to take a look at the contracting process, even when it isn't maybe a sexy issue or you know, just run-of-the-mill issues of how we administer these contracts are things that we would ask the committee to consider bringing into the spotlight. So I won't won't belabor the issue very much more. I'll be interested in looking at Ms. Lancaster's report as well, because I haven't seen it until now, and I definitely want to look at some of the concerns that the department has and see if there's a way we can reconcile those. I'll close though with just the comment that there is no substantive requirement imposed on contractors, and this was a question that came up just a couple of minutes ago. It's simply a reporting bill, so it's simply about transparency in this process. It doesn't say contractors are bad. It doesn't do anything other than put the information in a form that's available to the public and to you as policymakers.
I'm going to hear testimony from all three of the panel and then ask questions of all, if that's okay.
I'm Jerry Rosencutter, and I answer to Rosenwhat, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm a public employee for 17 years, and I've worked in the trenches of programming for a state agency. I'm also a long-term member of SEIU, and I have tracked with some interest the contracting out issue. Contracting of state funds, state functions is widespread already, but its extent is difficult to measure due to unavailability of solid information. The entire ODOT engineering, I'm not experienced with a microphone, so.
Don't worry about it, you're fine.
The entire ODOT engineering and oversight function has been contracted out during the past decade. The career path for ODOT engineers has been to seek work with the contractors if at all possible. There's been no performance evaluation that's public that I know about, which might compare the costs and benefits of those procedures. Cost savings are promised but often don't materialize. The Consolidated State Data Center has been and will continue to be beneficial for state government. Cost savings will not be realized in the first biennium as promised by the contractor, that was Accenture. These savings will not come from reduced FTE positions, but from consolidation of software licensing and computer program platforms. Private contracts can mean loss of service quality, and the state's investment in our well-trained public workforce is lost. And it also, public and private employees operate under different missions, goals, and ethical guidelines. Public employees who violate confidentiality rules are dismissed and blackballed from future government employment. Contractors could simply shift an employee to a different contract or reincorporate under a different corporate banner. Private contracts are frequently awarded without real competitive bidding. Many of the services which government provides are those for which there is no inherent competition. A private contractor's loyalty is to stockholders who might require as much as a 40% margin of profit. Bad apple contractors without adequate oversight create the potential for a waste of taxpayers' funds, conflicts of interest, and other questionable practices. I have a 2-inch thick notebook of press clippings. They deal with conspicuous and politically embarrassing failures of contracting at every level, from local Oregon government to federally subsidized programs. If the committee is aware of these things, I would request that this committee or any other legislative body produce any similar press release which describes a success of privatization in cost and quality of services. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sonia Reichwein. I've been a public employee for 9 years, and I am suddenly very nervous. I am for this bill for 3 reasons. First of all, transparency, accountability, and because I believe that this bill will save the state of Oregon money in the long run. when, for transparency, when state agencies do the work, taxpayers and legislators have access to the details of the work. They know how much they're paying. They know what they're getting for their money. When a contractor does the work, that transparency is gone. This bill creates a database of statewide contracts that will help with that. It will benefit agencies. We'll be able to see what contractors have done for other agencies and how they performed. And it'll benefit legislators because they'll be able to see that also. Secondly, I support it for accountability. At the present time, there's no way to track state contracts. A contractor could have multiple contracts with multiple agencies, and there would be no way to track when there were cost overruns, when there were delays, or when contractors provided a bad product or a bad service. With a database, legislators and agencies could see who the good contractors are, and they could separate out the bad contractors. In the long run, I also believe it would save the state of Oregon and the taxpayers, including me, money. Under my labor contract, I work for DMV, and I am president of the DMV local. My agency is required to perform feasibility studies whenever bargaining unit work is contracted out. So I get copies of these feasibility studies. In particular, with IT work, I've seen time and time again where the state is paying more money to get this for contracted out work than they would pay if state employees did the work. But that may be going on at other agencies. It may also be going on with work that is not bargaining unit work, but there's no way to see that. So this is a clue that this is going on. And if this was public information, this would encourage people to fix the problem. So with this bill, I believe we can track the contractors, find the good ones, weed out the bad ones. I think we can save Oregon money. We can improve accountability, and we'll have transparency in the process. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Duran.
The question I would have goes to the amount that the trigger, both the floor and the ceiling, that right now you already have accountability, if I'm not mistaken, from what was given by the individual from DAS, that anything over $150,000 requires full disclosure. So why $150,000 for a contract really isn't that substantial. So why drop it down to 15, which seems
actually I can address that, Mr. Chair and Representative Girard. This is more of a urban legend, if you will, but many of us are familiar with a custom. You mentioned the floor. I thought there was a $75,000 figure mentioned.
$15,000.
I'm sorry, for existing reporting.
$150,000. What I understood from the department was it.
Well,
we can get that. We can get that.
Right. Where I was going with that is that some agencies have a practice of continually hiring the same contractor at a figure which doesn't trigger reporting procedures. So the same contractor could be in for a six-month contract and then the revolving door into another six-month contract, all with the target of holding under this whatever threshold figure we set.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure where the $15,000 figure came from either, to tell you the truth. I think in terms of our goals and what we would like to see from this bill, certainly there would have to be some de minimis standard below which reporting requirement wouldn't come into play. No one wants agencies buying paper clips, having to file paperwork for doing that. What we do want, though, is as much transparency and openness in the process as we can. And so obviously the higher you set that limit, the less you're going to be capturing and the less you'll be able to provide good solid information to the public and to your colleagues as well. But we're not wedded to a particular dollar amount. I mean, we're interested in hearing what DAS and other agencies have to say about what that cutoff ought to be.
Representative Thatcher.
Well, I think I like where you're going. I think it's a good idea to have accountability that reaches down to see where the government's spending its money. Just having had experience being a contractor, as I'm sure you are aware, you were talking about cost overruns and or delays, and they're not always the fault of a contractor. I just wanted to make that perfectly clear. And if there's all, you know, just because you see this contractor had delays or this contractor had claims, a lot of times it's the administration of the contract by the state employees, you know, or whoever's in charge. Oh, all the time. And I'm just saying that, you know, you should look at the whole issue in both sides of the issue and not just whether or not there were actual delays or cost overruns. And I do believe that you're going the right direction, though.
Representative Edwards.
I was just, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. From your folks' perspective, and I've just been reading this bill, does this distinguish between for-profit contractors and not-for-profit contractors? I don't think it does, and it's something that I wanted to throw out there as an item for discussion. And the reason I bring it up is, I'm thinking out loud here. It's dangerous, but that's okay. There are special ed contracts that are administered by the state and EC Cares happens to be they're not for profit contractor, but we're certainly spending state dollars on that, and I think that there is quite a difference in potentially in transparency that we're attempting to ferret out here with this bill between a not-for-profit that doesn't have the profit motive and therefore I think probably doesn't have the same potential abuse for I don't know. I'm not saying that I want to go there with this bill. I'm throwing it out there. I'd like some comments and discussion. And
sure, I think that's a reasonable discussion. Yeah. I think the goal of this is not to point fingers at contractors, whether
right.
public or private, but to figure out if there's a better way for the state to run the business of being of the state. And I think that's the goal.
Yeah.
Any other? Yes.
Just a comment. I think a lot of cases that there isn't enough competition for sure,
mm-hmm.
and there are various reasons for that. And I would like to see state employees be able to actually be a contracting bidding body. I think that would be fine. I think that would be great if you were to do that. I know that they've done it successfully in some other areas, even though you could potentially be one of my competitors. That's okay. I really think that's healthy.
Would you like to comment on that?
If I may, Chair Riley and Representative Thatcher, I understand that there are certain sections in code now that allow groups of public employees to sort of band together and put in a bid on something. I have had no luck digging up any actual instance where that's happened in Oregon. So I would love to talk to you if you're aware of some of those and maybe look into them in a little more detail.
I think it would be great to maybe talk to the employees and see why they haven't been able. I didn't even know we had that ability here in Oregon as it's written, and maybe we need to change that and make it so it's more applicable, you know, usable, whatever it is that would allow you to do that.
Can I?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our contract does allow us to do that. The feasibility studies that I was referring to had to do with IT technology work, and in all of those cases, it costs more to do the work by contracting it out. The agency was unable to have state employees do the work because they don't have position authority for those positions. They're not allowed to hire people to do the work. So our counterproposals are always, well, let us lobby the legislator to help you out, or let us keep the work in-house, but that hasn't gone anywhere. So,
could you explain that a little bit better? This committee actually has oversight over IT, And I would like to hear a little bit more about what you just said and maybe in a little more detail, because I didn't quite get the full meat of that.
Well, actually, I have a report that SEIU compiled this year. It's just on ODOT and DMV. And just our contract requires the agency to give us feasibility studies on contracted out work. So just there's one paragraph in particular, if I could have your permission to read just that short one. So far during the 2005-2007 biennium, ODOT, including DMV, has provided the union with feasibility studies for an estimated just over $9 million worth of information technology work. By ODOT's own estimates, the same work, if performed by state employees, would cost only just over $5 million. So by its own estimates, ODOT will incur an additional cost of almost $4 million because the work was outsourced rather than performed in-house. I did not bring copies of the feasibility studies with me, but I can get them as president of my local, and also the ODOT president has copies of those. And they show time after time where they just cannot, they don't have the position authority. We're limited to how many positions the agency can hire for. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
And
yes, go ahead.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, just to maybe clarify, because I didn't really understand how this works myself, but under our contracts that our members have, various bargaining units, there's language requiring a feasibility study if the agency wants to take a particular position and convert it into a function that's now contracted out. They have to write a feasibility study, and these things cross my desk, they cross Sonia's desk, and they all end up in our research department here in our Salem office. So Andrew Bogner, who's our senior researcher, went through and looked at these reports, and I can make sure, I just have the one copy. Oh, we do have more copies. Great. I can make sure that you guys get copies of this. It's specific to ODOT and it's specific to IT contracts.
Just hand them to the assistant.
That's one of the things I was referring to when I said that we only know really the tip of the iceberg. This isn't necessarily, obviously it's limited. It's only ODOT. It's only IT functions. But the other way in which it's limited is that it requires there to be an FTE on the books, a classified position that's now being converted over. And since the state has had budget issues, year in and year out for quite a while now, every agency has positions that have been eliminated over time. And so if you reach a point down the road where there's some function that doesn't have an identifiable classified position that's now being eliminated, then they don't have to do a feasibility study and send it to us. We're not representing that employee. So any functions that are sort of the function has been eliminated over time due to budget cuts, and now they've decided they need to contract something out, that's not going to be captured in the feasibility study process either.
I understand. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to call Mary Botkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I had not intended to testify. I was just going to sit back there quietly and listen to what the bill did. But in listening to Representative Thatcher talk about the possibilities of public employees bidding and providing some alternatives to contracting out to the private sector, I am compelled to say that the City of Portland Water Bureau was successful in contracting to maintain services in Portland, and the case of the City of Portland Water Bureau and the administration went all the way, I mean, it went through court with AGC suing several times over the cost analysis that we used. We were also the union in a position, in the position during the reinventing government efforts in Philadelphia, where we actually bid on some of our jobs there. We have quite an extensive experience in providing bids for our own jobs and providing new and different ways to provide government services. Having said that, I can attempt to recapture some of the information from the City of Portland experience. We've had a lot of staff turnover. We've had a lot of member turnover. And, in fact, the three members who were actively leaders of our local union, Local 189 in the City of Portland at the time, are now all in management at the Water Bureau. and I'm actually still friends with all three of them, so I can ask them if they have anything or if they know where I can find any of the information I could share with the committee or the committee administrator. Let me just say that this bill intrigues us a lot. We're also scratching our head over the food service issues at the Department of Corrections, trying to be supportive of our director and at the same time wondering how in the devil this happened and nobody noticed that he was driving around in a very expensive sports car in a lavish home with a lifestyle that clearly exceeded anything that most public employees could afford, even management level public employees. But it seemed to escape everybody's notice, and we'd like to see some oversight on that. We're sort of under the impression that that's what the Secretary of State's Audit Division is supposed to do. Whether or not they have the staffing and the resources to do it is a question, but be that as it may. We think that there's appropriate uses for public for contracting out some services. Where they're not generally needed every day, all the time, 24/7. You know, some of the services that we contract for regularly are flagging services, as Representative Thatcher knows. And we also use a lot of interpretive services, where we contract with folks who have very specific skills. And we do that a lot in our human resources agencies at the local level and with some of our court services at the local level. So, I mean, there are appropriate uses of private contractors. And, you know, I think that what this bill is attempting to do is a great idea. I think shining a light on where we're contracting, what we're contracting for, you know, examining that should not be feared by legitimate law-abiding contractors any more than it should be feared by public employees. And I think we have a lot to come together on with this. And if we can save money for the taxpayers and for governmental services, then maybe we can spend some of that money in some areas where we need a little more money. But having said that, I will attempt to find some of the information from the City of Portland contracting experience that they had. And if nothing else, I'll try and find the court documents. I mean, I know the courts have documents, and I'm sure AGC has probably buckets of files on this. So, but I do know that we were, in the end, successful at hanging on to the jobs at the Portland Water Bureau because we did things differently. So,
questions? Representative Byer?
Thank you. I guess the original question I asked was the dollar amount in this bill and whether you had any kind of feedback on that.
None. You know, I didn't even look at the public contracting limitations now. I don't know where, I can't remember where they are now. It used to be about $50,000 before you had to go out for bid, but that was on a public improvement, and I don't want to. The folks that were just up here probably know much more about this than I do, or more recently, anyway.
Sure, I could. I don't know what I was going to ask, but
Oh, I remember. You were commenting on there are certain instances where contracting is appropriate. And I guess I see it as competition is good and include, you know, public employees in that. They know where the bodies are buried. They know they know how to do their jobs better than anybody. They can be inventive and, you know,
that's Michael Franken.
Yeah. There can be creative ways of getting something done at a less cost to the taxpayer, and I think that's good for everybody. And if a private company can beat that, then so be it. If not, then, you know, we've saved money. And I think that competition is the biggest key here.
Burying the bodies was a different bill today.
Oh, sorry, yeah, that one, I guess it was.
And I think as long as we're talking about equivalent services with equivalent oversight and equivalent adjustments for, what, you know, the public needs, you know, sometimes that's what public contractors or what contractors have difficulty understanding when they come into a governmental agency. They don't understand that sometimes what we're doing today may not be what we're doing tomorrow, and that we have to respond quickly to the demands and the needs of a client base that is demanding and fluid in those demands. And sometimes we have to change quicker than the private sector is used to having to change. Not to say that they can't, but sometimes that's a difficult challenge for them. And so that's why I say in some areas there are real good reasons to contract for very specialized services in very specialized areas. And in other areas where we're going to have a long-term relationship, I think it makes. I mean, we don't build prisons. There's a reason we don't build prisons. You know, somebody suggested once that we should let the inmates build the prisons. We think that's a real bad idea. You know?
Okay. With that,
no more bodies, no more.
with that, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Committee members, this has a ways and means. The time is getting short. If we want to get this anywhere, we're going to have to do it soon because it does have a ways and means referral. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on this? I'm going to close the public hearing on 3366, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3366.
Okay. I actually was going to ask for some amendments.
I think it needs some work still. I mean, I like the direction.
Well, let's have some discussion about it.
Okay. First of all, the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House, I'm looking out for you guys in the House because we're going to retake the House next session. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that the minority leaders are various bills as well.
Oh, okay. And I think that's appropriate. And then I also, what Patrick was showing me, section 6, it talks about a kind of a readout or where they blank out the Social Security number.
Redacting.
That does not apply to those that are given to the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House and et cetera, the way the bill's written. So I kind of, at least the way that I read it, because it's the copies to the public, so that needs to be that their copies as well would be redacted as well. So those two points are kind of trivial points, but I'm one of those people that like things nice and neat and that sort of thing.
Would you like to head up a work group?
Well, I could, but I'd also like to hear from DAS again. What was the ceiling?
If you could come.
What is the dollar amount that now triggers a public
where it's given out to the public.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Riley, Representative Gerard. The dollar amounts, and I know this gets confusing sometimes because there's a lot of numbers in here, at $150,000, generally goods and services are competitively solicited. There are some differences in the construction of public improvements, and I think sometimes those numbers can get a little add to some confusion. But for general goods and services, $150,000.
And if I may, the $15,000 number to me seems exceptionally low. Maybe I'm kind of the wrong guy to be asking here, but it's just $15,000 on a project, if you're contracting out, is not a very big project. And so I'm just trying to cut out the red tape for DAS here. Do you have any input as to where you might like that figure, or is that are you just going to go with the flow here?
Well, Representative Riley, Representative Gerard, of course this is a policy decision and we defer to you, but currently agencies are required to report some information about personal services at $5,000. I don't know if 15, if you bumped it up to 150, if that would make a significant difference in terms of the burden on agencies and the contractors who have to supply that detailed employee information. Certainly I would think that would make some difference to them and the burden it would put on them. For DAS, the main issue that I see for DAS is the technological issue. It is creating the connections and the systems, in order to get this information into a centralized data repository. So once you've done that, I think that's the heavy lifting. Then the dollar level becomes probably more of a question of burden on the state agency at the ground level with the contractor with whom they're interacting.
Okay. Representative Meyer again.
Thank you. I tend to think that 150 is way too high, although I wondered about 15. But I guess there was some comments about smaller contracts that agencies are making kind of fly under the radar, and then they temporary employees or something, and then they renew them after they've expired, and then they reestablish these contracts to kind of get out of the big picture reporting. And I was curious if you have any information on that, whether that's a common practice or...
Sure. Representative Riley, Representative Beyer. The practice of breaking down a contract into smaller parts in order to fly under the radar screen, so to speak, certainly it's not unheard of. How often it happens, I couldn't speak to. Obviously, that's an auditing function where they go through and look at a particular project. At $5,000 for a major project, that would be so burdensome, I think it would be either caught at the agency level or it would just be so burdensome. So those would be my observations. Again, as far as personal services or consulting services that are called personal services now, because the agency has to report each $5,000 level, that kind of breaking down would have to go on at a below a $5,000 level, or else folks could see an agency report of, say, $5,100 over and over and over again in the current reporting system for at least that body of work. That may be a roundabout answer to get to your question, ma'am. I hope I've helped in some way.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Throwing this out there, thinking out loud, which we all know is dangerous, right? Right now, for instance, with campaign contributions, you have to report after it reaches a certain aggregate amount. And I'm wondering if that would answer, once you reach a certain aggregate, we could figure out what that is, so we don't have those rollovers of small contracts that really end up being large contracts in the long run. I'm wondering if that would answer that concern.
Representative Riley, Representative Thatcher, there are, of course, laws and policies that actually do prohibit state agencies from practicing this kind of process. And we at least treat the current levels that we're speaking about as an annual aggregate, so that if an agency were to anticipate paying at least currently paying a personal service provider more than $5,000 in a year, it comes then into the what we call the informal quotation process, where they're supposed to obtain and document independent quotes for that work. Now, that's the way the system currently, you know, it prohibits anything different than that. Can there be violations of that? Certainly there can be. But just to answer your question, ma'am, it is currently an annual aggregate.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess I know time is of the essence, and I think this is a good concept, and I think we probably have the votes on the committee to move it out. I am concerned that we haven't had, and I don't know, maybe those contractors knew about this, and their silence is approval. But we haven't heard from any nonprofit contractors that provide a lot of services with tax dollars to the state. They don't have a profit motive, and they're very much vested in the state Ways and Means budgeting process, seeing money allocated to different sectors of the budget. And I'd really like a chance to hear from some of them as to they may be collecting all this. It's not an area of regulation that I'm really that familiar with. You know, they may be collecting all this stuff already, and they just say, oh, it's no big deal. And it may be extremely burdensome. I just don't know. And so I'd really like, I'm respectfully requesting that if the time frame works, if we could have until Thursday, which is the next time this committee meets, just to talk, make a few phone calls, talk with a few folks. I think that would be useful from my perspective, but if you really want to move this, I'd certainly be willing to work with you on that.
I would like time to get some amendments, so I'd be looking for more time than that.
Okay. I'm going to carry this over until next Tuesday, and I'm going to end this work session on House Bill 3366. That's everything we're going to work today, and I appreciate you all being here, and I'm going to close this meeting. Thank you.